I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. It is February 17, 2001, and I'm a committee of one at this point. For those in their offices, would you please come down and get here? We have a number of veterans bills that we are going to hear. I am very excited about what our task force has done over the past interim and the bills that they're bringing forward. And so and then each time I have a conversation, it seems like we're doing more and more, not just here in the Oregon, but also at the federal level, because there is so much that we need to do with our guard in particular. So with that, I would like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 98. Mr. Shook, do you want to tell us what that's all about? And if I could have the witness registration, please. Good morning, Senator Morissette.
There's a quorum in.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 98 creates a task force on veterans transportation and directs the task force to study methods to create transportation for veterans to access health care. This is a what we call, I guess, a sunset provision. It would be a task force for a 2-year period of time during the interim, and then to make recommendations to the Legislative Assembly next legislative session.
Excellent. So Jim Willis, and Kevin O'Reilly, and Paul Evans. And while you're getting seated, Senator Morissette, what did you say about...
There are three members of the committee that I think are still in the caucus room meeting on a Senate Bill 76 issue. They should be here shortly. I left early.
Okay. All right.
So I could be here on time.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
As a committee chair, I appreciate it too.
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to come here today, and I'll try to talk slow but still effectively as did the three members arrive. For the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm a policy advisor with Governor Kulongoski on military emergency management and veterans issues. I also had kind of a double hat in that I was privileged to serve as the chair of the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services. Before I begin with the comments, I really do want to take the opportunity and say that largely because of the folks that are in this room and another 25 that would like to be in this room, Oregon has something unique because of the task force process. Some time ago, General Washington once said that the willingness with which young people are likely to serve in any war, no matter how justified, shall be directly proportional to how they perceive veterans of early wars were treated and appreciated by our nation. We are in an interesting time, and Governor Kulongoski and members of the legislature and about 35 other folks came together to try to put together a task force that went through and systematically looked at educational, environment, healthcare, retirement, aging issues, as well as unemployment and family issues having to do with veterans. And the report put forward several different recommendations. This Senate Bill 98 is one of those recommendations. Everybody should have already received the handy-dandy slideshow presentation that gives some of the background on where we're at and why we're here. I won't waste the task force or the committee's time on that except to say the following.
Do we have that?
Yes.
Again, Cassandra. Oh, this is mine and not...
Should look like this, ma'am.
Thank
yes.
you.
Bottom line is there are 350,000 veterans in Oregon according to the census, and only about 80,000 veterans currently enrolled in the VA system. Veterans, I've gotten a little bit of teasing about this, but I believe it's true. Veterans are a lot like salmon. They're very hard to count and they move, so we don't really have an exact number on that. One of the priorities of this task force report will be to help emphasize outreach efforts. Senate Bill 98 specifically is one of the three pieces of the task force work left undone, and I want to emphasize that. The governor's executive order provided the ability to have town hall meetings, to have discussions of policy subject matter experts, to have input, and I think one of the best analysis done throughout the country. But we did have a timeline, and there were some things we just could not get done by December. Didn't want to say that we could if we weren't able to. As we went throughout the process, we recognized that transportation is one of those issues that wherever you are in the state, really it depends on a number of factors. Some areas have very good local transit areas. Some areas have quite literally a borrowed van and the change from cans taken into to Safeway. So what we tried to recognize is that in those areas that require further study, that we wanted to have a work group. Legislative Council suggested that the term is actually task force now for everything, so we just are here to make sure that there's a sanctioned effort from the legislature that says that the transportation piece of getting veterans to and from care is important enough that the legislature wants to have a date certain, wants to have the right people around the table, and to get the answers that we just didn't have time to get. And with those comments, I'll conclude and hand it over to Jim.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, professional staff. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here in strong support of Senate Bill 98, which creates the Veterans Transportation Task Force, as identified moments ago by Paul Evans, as coming out of the work of the Governor's Task Force on Veterans Services. For many Oregon veterans who live in rural and remote parts of our state, transportation to VA medical facilities is nearly impossible. The situation is even worse for wheelchair-bound veterans. Oregon does have a limited veterans transportation system of 23 vans operated by the Disabled American Veterans Service Organization in partnership with the federal VA. However, there are not enough vans to cover the state, and these vans cannot accept wheelchair-bound passengers. I believe that Chair Evans pointed out very clearly that the task force identified this as an important issue. But what we have to understand is that the veterans' transportation needs is also a federal issue. We've submitted Senate Joint Memorial 2, which urges Congress to fund an Oregon veterans' transportation system. And I'm happy to tell the chair and the members of this committee that each of the joint memorials, both coming out of the Senate and the House, has been worked through with our congressional delegation. And in the case of this important effort on veterans transportation, Congressman DeFazio has agreed to work at it at the U.S. Congress level. The reason we think this is important is because we think we might be able to provide a creative, innovative public-private solution to help veterans across the state access the health care they need and have earned. We also are urging Congress to fund this because we believe this is a continuation of a federal responsibility to get these veterans to the federal health care through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs health care system. I'd like to thank the committee for your consideration of this important memorial, and I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
Explain a little bit about the funding, because it says it may have a revenue impact, but a statement for this bill hasn't come. So could you address that issue?
Chair Moss Anderson, members of the committee, yes.
Never mind. We got the fiscal impact.
Okay. It shouldn't be.
It says no revenue impact.
Yes, ma'am.
Minimal expenditure.
And minimal expenditure.
Yes, ma'am. Much of the questions have been raised. Right now it's trying to get the people that are the experts around the table to be able to have the conversations. So most of the costs have already been taken care of at this point.
Okay. Great.
Good morning. Chairman Anderson, member of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I am representing the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, and we're the state chapter of a National Veterans Service Organization. We particularly like this bill because, most of our members are in wheelchairs, and we find it very difficult to access our health care in Roseburg or CBOC or up in Portland. Quite a few of us live in rural areas, family and that sort of thing. This is a particularly good and interesting bill because it has the potential to help not only veterans, but other members of the community, other citizens in Portland, in Oregon, not just Portland, of course. And we particularly like it for that reason. And that pretty much concludes my testimony today on this particular bill.
All right. Is there any further discussion?
Any questions? I have a question for
Mr. Evans, I know that your task force members were varied and a lot of people around the state involved in all parts of the state. When this started, you had a certain county commissioner who worked pretty hard on the task force, and then the report was published, and now she has a new job.
Chair Moss, and on that, Mr. Shook, yes. This task force has been an amazing journey. There have been a lot of interesting changes, one of which, of course, that you're alluding to, sir, is Commissioner Schrader, now State Senator Martha Schrader, was a pivotal part of the task force. One of those opportunities, we recognized that we had to get a big enough group to represent all the different varied interests, and Clackamas County is one of the leaders in veterans policy. And she has not only been an important part of the task force, but on a number of side projects to help make things happen along the way. She played an important role. The way we really envisioned it was that we would have an information gathering process. How it turned out, quite frankly, was that after the initial couple of months of information gathering, our 6 town hall plan became a 24 community plan for town hall meetings. And as we went, we were able to recognize problems, and in some cases, actually through VSOs like Tom and others, we were able to help solve problems along the way. And Clackamas County is one of those cases where they had a good plan for a reintegration day and a jobs day, and as more people were around the table, I think that program got even better. So it was a win-win for everybody.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to call Senator Schrader up.
Can you get under all right, Jim? Oh, don't worry. I'm not fragile.
Old home week.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and colleagues, for allowing me just to step in this morning before my Ways and Means subcommittee meeting at 8:30. I'm here in support of these bills and to actually thank publicly the wonderful members of that task force. I want to thank Paul for his kind words, but it was really Paul's initiative, as well as all the members of that task force, that I believe brought forward to you this legislative session a larger package of what we need to be doing for our veterans. As you already know, we are experiencing the largest deployment of the Guard since World War II. We have a number of our folks who have been out on multiple deployments as well. And when I had my hat on as a county commissioner, we decided in our county that we would do the full meal deal for our veterans, largely because Camp Withicum is a big part of our county community. So,
can you tell us what Camp Withicum is?
Camp Withicum is our Guard base in our industrial area, actually, in Clackamas County. And they actually are a huge job multiplier and economic kind of motivator in our area. They actually repair night vision goggles, pumps, all those kinds of things, and do contracting out with our local businesses. So I initially contacted the folks at Camp Withicum because of economic development issues, and then realized that what was going on with our veterans was a larger piece of what we needed to do. So our philosophy at the county, which I hope translates into some of the legislation that we're going to be passing, as well as how we're going to look at things statewide, is to prepare the families and the veterans for deployment, give the families the services they need while their loved ones are serving our country and serving our state, and then, God willing, when they return home, to also welcome them with jobs, with housing, with education, with social service needs, should they have them, across the continuum. So I am hopeful that the legislation that you see today will be a part of that continuum, and that I will continue with you to work on behalf of our veterans on these issues. So thank you so much for allowing me to be here, and do you have any questions?
Okay. Now, Camp Withicum is a special spot in my heart, too, because when working for Clackamas County, especially in the 96 floods, that was the base for FEMA. And
absolutely,
we public health nurses were very much a part of that process in screening individuals and giving immunizations and all kinds of things there. So,
well, they're a wonderful presence in Clackamas County, and as I said, anything we can do to help our guard and our veterans, other branches of the service, we're there. We're there for them, as you are. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Shady, would you be willing to carry this bill on the floor? I think it would be appropriate.
I would be honored to carry the bill if it's the courtesy of the committee.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, we haven't worked it yet, so
well,
I don't know.
Yeah,
it's going to be a tough one.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 98, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 98.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 98 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 98 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Thank goodness there's a quorum. Is there any opposition? Please note that Senator Bates and Senator Morissette. Oh, you're here.
Okay,
Senator Bates is excused. Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator
Bates? Aye. All right, with that, Senate Bill 98 is passed, and Senator Schrader will carry it. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 98, and I will open a work session on SJM 1. And if I could have the
Madam Chair,
registration, please.
JM 1 urges Congress to allow Oregon veterans to obtain state home loans at any time after a veteran separates from service. We actually have SJM 1, 2, 3, and 4, all of which start with urging Congress, and our representatives will walk through each one of these.
Okay. Jim Riley, Paul Evans, and Jim Willis, Paul Evans, and Kevin O'Reilly.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, before you, as Director Willis mentioned a few minutes ago, we have a host of memorials coming through the legislature this time, and we were sensitive from the beginning that memorials sometimes are great ways to pass something and then often not a lot gets done from that. So from the very beginning, we had a commitment to ourselves, and I want to make that commitment to each of you. Every memorial that we're asking you to stand up for, we have been doing our homework in terms of building a coalition, both through the Oregon delegation as well as through national organizations, state departments of Veterans Affairs, as well as other veterans advocacy groups. So what we're hoping and what we believe is in fact the case is that the memorials that Oregon passes this year, hopefully, are similar, if not exact, wording that will be kind of echoed throughout the echo chamber in D.C. among all the veteran service organizations, because we recognize that when you have the size and scale of problem that we have right now, which is the for many years an underfunded VA system that now has to catch up with the needs of the Vietnam era generation, as well as many more and in arguably difficult, more difficult kinds of situations to deal with the 2% of the folks that are fighting the war, we have our work cut out for us. And that was really the purpose of the task force, to prioritize what the major game changers were at the federal level. Senate Joint Memorial 1 is having to do with urging Congress to eliminate time restrictions on state home loans. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about SJM 2 and 3 as they come up. I'm actually going to hand this one over to Director Willis to explain how this one actually fits into something that we have a little more control over here at home.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of Senate Joint Memorial 1, which urges Congress to make state veterans' home loans a lifetime benefit by eliminating the 25-year restriction of veterans using the qualified veterans' mortgage bonds. And what that means, in other words, is that you can only use the state veterans' home loan within 25 years of your date of discharge.
The Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services heard from many veterans that feel this restriction is arbitrary, especially considering that the Federal Veterans Administration home loan is a lifetime benefit. Under the current rules, all Oregon veterans are no longer eligible for this program as soon as they pass that 25 years from date of discharge. Senate Joint Memorial 1 is part of a two-step approach to make the loan a lifetime benefit. Senate Joint Memorial 1 urges congressional action to eliminate the federal restriction. And as I said before, we have a congressional champion for this memorial as well. In this case, that is Congressman Blumenauer. His office has agreed to carry this issue in the U.S. Congress. By eliminating both the federal and state restrictions, and the state one would be eliminated by passing House Joint Resolution 7, which would result in proposing a constitutional amendment to the people of the state of Oregon, which would eliminate a similar restriction that's currently in the state constitution. By eliminating both of these, the federal and state restriction, the OrVet home loan would be available to veterans throughout their lifetime, which we believe is important to Oregon veterans. I would point out that only 5 states in the Union offer a state veterans home loan. They are Alaska, Oregon, California, Wisconsin, and Texas. Those 5 states contain 20% of the entire nation's veteran population. So it's a large number of people that would be impacted. And I'm happy to tell you that the 4 other states who join with Oregon in this effort are all 100% behind our effort here at the state level and are joining us with the effort at the congressional level. I feel very confident we can make this happen, and I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to bring it to the committee this morning. I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone may have.
My father had a vet loan, and it's a one-time deal, correct? And who offers that loan? Is it through the federal government then? And tell us what the going interest rate on that is.
The federal VA home loan is almost always a higher interest rate than our state. Currently, the state home loan is offered at 5.375. Or 5.25, depending on the origination, at 1% or 1.5%. I might point out in this particular time in our nation's history that these are fixed-rate 30-year loans. You make your first payment to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and you make your last payment there. Okay. We never sell these loans, and because of our underwriting process, we never make even close to what's called a subprime loan. That just doesn't happen. And currently, we are operating at less than 1% delinquency rate on our total loan portfolio, which is almost unheard of in the industry.
You should take over the banking industry.
Well, thank you, Chair, but I don't have to do that right now. We'll stick with what we know how to do. So we are and continue to be a very good deal for Oregon. And since 1945, we've made over 333,000 home loans to Oregon veterans, and we want to continue to do that. But today, our veterans are working longer than ever before. Our whole society is. So it's not unusual for people to work 30, 35 years, both the husband and the wife, either of which may be the veteran. Then they wrap up a successful career either in the public or private sector. They come down to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to get their long-awaited home loan, only to find out that their benefit expired and they no longer are eligible. It's a very tough situation, and we can fix this. And the other thing I would point out, when congressional members of Congress might say, well, listen, why should we allow these states to have a lifetime benefit just because we give the lifetime benefit at the federal level? The issue here is that the risk in funding this program is not taken by the federal government. It's taken by the state of Oregon through the sale of the qualified veterans mortgage bonds. So we have to monitor that program very carefully, make sure that you don't get upside down between the amount of interest you're paying on your bond debt and the amount of interest you're charging the recipient. So if those get
reversed, as they did in the early 80s, it creates a very serious problem. I can assure this committee that is not the case, and it won't be the case as far as I'm concerned, as long as I'm there and lone people are operating this program the way we are today, which is in the black.
Okay. Is there any questions? Right. With that, I'd like to close Senate Joint Memorial 1 public hearing and open a work session on Senate Joint Memorial 1.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Joint Memorial 1 to the floor of the Senate with a do adopt
motion.
No fiscal.
We have a revenue on this and no fiscal.
Yes.
So will you withdraw your motion?
I don't want to. We already know there's no fiscal on this.
Yeah.
Okay.
It says it may have a fiscal impact, but we do not have the statement.
Well, Madam Chair, the SMS always shows that until we get one. But I will. It would just have been nice to have all of these on the floor at the same time. But that could probably still be arranged.
Madam Chair, legislative fiscal has indicated they'll have those this week. So next Tuesday, we'll be able to vote on all of these.
Okay. In that case, Madam Chair, I will reluctantly withdraw my motion.
With that, I'd like to close the work session on SJM 1 and open a public hearing on SJM 2.
Madam Chair, SJM 2 is much like Senate Bill 98. It urges Congress to enact legislation creating statewide transportation systems to provide transportation for Oregon veterans, particularly disabled veterans, to and from medical facilities.
All right. We have Jim Willis, Paul Evans, Kevin O'Reilly, and he never spoke on the last one. We were just so excited about getting it through. Okay, let's start with Jim and Paul.
Chair Moss Anderson, basically, you know the issues involved. The one thing I do want to emphasize on, because Senate Joint Memorial 2 and, well, we'll talk about Senate Joint Memorial 3, are really two pieces of what we see as a PINCE movement, a classic PINCE movement. And what I mean by this, currently the Veterans Health Administration has not done a very good job in terms of transportation for veterans living in remote and rural areas, and in many cases they've not been as aggressive as we hope they would be in pushing services more local. So what we're trying to do through these memorials, and especially through Senate Joint Memorial 2, is emphasize that if the current system is the system that's going to stay in terms of where the major hospitals are and things like that, we have to get more efficient and more effective at getting veterans to and from, even if they live in remote and rural areas. And that's one of the big pushes. And we believe that the pressure, especially supported by Congressman DeFazio, is the way he can support things. We believe that that will engage them on recognizing that, especially among the remote and rural areas and states west of the Mississippi, where you can drive hours and still be in the same state, we have to rethink some things that we haven't done before. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. My testimony on Senate Joint Memorial 2 would be much the same as it was on Senate 98. So let me simply say, this is the vehicle that will allow us to transfer the feelings of this body to the United States Congress, and I believe will be felt by veterans organizations and by the state directors across the nation in the 50 states and the four U.S. territories to be something that needs to be done, and I think we'll have very strong support for this. I ask for your strong consideration of the passage of SJM 2.
And I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Senator Moniz Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly, and I represent the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, again, the state chapter of a national veterans service organization. In the interest of full disclosure, I was also on the governor's task force, I think, mainly because Paul realized he needed a disgruntled veteran on there, and I fit the bill. Transportation to veterans to health care is not only an Oregon problem. every state, even the eastern states where things are nice and tight and close together, have this. They have rural areas, and those areas still have the same problem. Veterans being able to access their health care. This would start that process of helping ensure that a veteran has the opportunity to access their health care that is at times many, many hours away, and in the winter can be quite hazardous. And therefore, we have, you know, our full support behind this bill. Or memorial, actually.
All right. And Bob, is it Plain?
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you for the privilege of coming before you. I'm Bob Plame, retired Marine Corps and disabled veteran, and have been honored to be on this task force for veteran services. Transportation system, I live in Portland, and VA hospital is right there, so it wasn't an issue for me, or I thought much about it, until we traveled rural Oregon, Burns, Bend, LeGrand, other areas, and went to town hall meetings and saw these veterans and their issue with trying to get to the medical system. The medical system's quite good. They just couldn't get there in the wintertime coming over the mountains. They couldn't get there if they were wheelchair-bound. A coordination of all this and a funding by the federal government sends a strong signal, I believe, to veterans that we're keeping the faith with you and to the men and women today serving our country and Oregon Guard that we're standing behind you. So I would like to ask you to follow through on this Senate Joint Measure 2 memorandum to Congress and tell them how we feel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, Senator.
Madam Chair, just to comment on this whole package and what I really appreciate, because we do a lot of memorials to Congress and have done that over my time in the building, but what I appreciate that this task force did was make the connections in D.C. so we would have champions on these measures, so we aren't just throwing things up in the wind this time, that we're actually helping our congressional delegation to move forward on the issues. So that was a brilliant stroke by the task force to make those connections, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Yes, Senator Bates?
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair, and I apologize for being late. It's been kind of a crazy morning. It's totally insane. You know, talk about insanity. We have veterans all across the state who have hospitals, physicians next door to them, but we have to transport them to Roseburg or to Portland to get health care when they should be getting it locally. And it's just a travesty that our healthcare system is broken down and siloed the way it is. You know, the VA is a great organization. They've transformed themselves in the last 15 years, one of the best healthcare delivery systems now, I would say, in the world. Very proud of them. But what we put some of our veterans through, especially rural ones, is amazing. I fly up here, you know, as you know, Sunday evenings, and there's always four or five veterans flying up with me, coming up to get up to Portland. Some of them are in a wheelchair, some of them aren't. It's a real disservice to them to make them do this, but that's the way the system is right now. I would like to see the VA tweak their system a bit and say, you know, bad weather, you're living in Burns, you could go see a local physician or hospital and we'll cover those costs for you, and not make you try to come clear across the mountains in the middle of the winter. That's a different issue. Failing that, getting a better transportation system together, I'm all for it. But you guys do a great job. The transportation that it allowed them now are pretty good, but sometimes it just isn't good enough. Right. A couple nights ago or a couple weeks ago, it was Sunday evening, there was five veterans flying off with me. The plane got canceled, and they all went home and had to make a run at it the next day. Right. So it is tough. And these are men who are not in good health. So I support this.
And Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Bates, I'm happy to report to you that you will be seeing House Joint Memorial 3 after it comes out of the House, which urges Congress to increase fee basis funding and simplify the rules for using fee basis, which allows local medical treatments and operations for those folks that can, those folks that live in places like Lakeview and Burns and Pendleton and so on. So
And then we also have congressional champions for that effort. That should have been taken care of many years ago, and I think will address very clearly what Senator Bates is talking about. So I'm happy to tell you that that's on the checkoff list as well.
All right. We do not have legislative fiscal. We do have our revenue impact statement. So, again, we won't go into work session here. I'll close the public hearing on SJM 2 and open a public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 3.
Madam Chair, SJM 3 urges Congress to enact legislation providing complete health care for all honorable discharge veterans and their dependents.
And we have Jim and Paul and Kevin start out with.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm still Paul Evans, policy advisor for Governor Kulongoski, and veterans issues is one of my areas. What I respectfully request that you do at this point in your handy-dandy slideshow handouts that maybe you've had a little chance to scribble on or look at in the last little bit, toward the end, in fact, the I believe fifth from the last page, there's a Task Force on Veteran Services Game Changers discussion. I'll just hold it in case you can't find it very easily. But bottom line, that we believe unanimously that the biggest game changer at the federal level, or I should say the biggest policy change at the federal level that could make a difference for veterans, is full funding for VHA categories 1 through 8. Senate Joint Memorial 3 speaks to that, and I want to emphasize a couple of things having to do with why this is critical and why this is the right time in history to change it. First, President Obama campaigned on full funding of all categories of veterans. As you know, when especially during tight budget times, bureaucracies are forced to constrict and constrain services that they provide, and often it has to do with making sometimes arbitrary or capricious decisions on disability levels that should be covered, or how much money a veteran may make to still have access to the veterans care that they've earned. What the task force believes is, and I like to emphasize a statement made by the man to my right, no one asked Jim how much he was making when they drafted and sent him to Vietnam. And sometimes we get wrapped around the axles about means testing, and we get wrapped around the axles in terms of whether 10% or 20% disability should get rated, should get assistance or not. What we believe is that if a person has served this country honorably, they have put the country ahead of their own needs, that they should have access to the VA care system. Because there are a lot of things, for military members especially, that are interconnected, and sometimes they're not found in a particular, as I think was alluded to earlier, silo process that looks for specific kinds of problems, but only those specific kinds of problems. We believe if you've served, especially in as complex an environment that the current combat world is, that if you have, if you've met that requirement, you should have access to the VA care. We also believe that the 350,000 veterans that the census says that are in Oregon, and again, there's only 80,000 registered in the VA system, that 270,000 veterans that would be entitled to health care, in many ways, if they had access to health care, it would probably transform the rest of the opportunities for people in Oregon to get services as well. Our argument all along had been, if we could get veterans into the veteran system, it would free up capacity among especially the categories where I believe the term is repeat customers, where people have specific kinds of problems that are very costly. So this is the right thing to do, first of all. Secondly, it's also the fiscally responsible thing to do. And third, it would actually provide states more flexibility, we believe, when the federal government lives up to its responsibility. The Congress, the new majorities in both houses, have said that they support this. The new president has said they support this. And in this particular context, our leader in D.C., we have kind of a couple of them, on the Senate side, of course, Senator Wyden. On the House side, actually, Congressman Walden, he wanted to make sure that he understood this is a bipartisan effort. This should not be a donkey or elephant. This should be just American. And he has offered to lead the, or at least coordinate the effort back there. So we're hoping that this memorial will send a signal that the states are serious. We're also hoping that once it's passed, you can talk to your colleagues across the nation and emphasize that from states' perspective, this would be the right thing to do and the helpful thing to do. Thank you again.
Okay.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of Veterans Affairs for the State of Oregon. Two quick comments. Number one, I love Paul like a brother, but I was not drafted. I enlisted.
Sorry.
They sent me to Vietnam. Didn't make a difference. Secondly, I just say the Senate Joint Memorial 3 is very well written. It's very well supported by the veterans community, and it's very well supported by, as Paul said, by both the president and members on both sides of the aisle and in both houses of the U.S. Congress. It's time to fix this bifurcation of veterans that determines whether you are or are not an honorably discharged veteran by some kind of means testing that determines whether you were or were not successful in later life. That has nothing to do with your honorable service to this nation, and this program should be fully funded. I'm happy to answer any questions. And here's Kevin.
Senator Mornes Anderson and members of the committee, my name again is Kevin O'Reilly with the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. And for all the reasons already given, this one also has something else, excuse me, in it that's kind of interesting because it says, and their dependents. Currently, a severely disabled veteran has access for his dependents for health care through a system called CHAMP VA, which is, from what I've never used it myself, it's even worse or more difficult to use than TRICARE. Fewer providers take it than do TRICARE. So that reduces health care for those dependents, or the opportunity for health care. It's also something else is going on currently in the veterans community, particularly with the younger, this generation of veterans, and they're asking us to look at their whole family. And that makes sense. It's timely. It's something that we should have done years ago, of course, and now this generation of veterans is asking us to do that, and I think that this bill takes us in that direction.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Marcy.
Thank you. Recently there was a veteran who froze to death in Lane County, a major, who slipped through the cracks, which I think is terrible, 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 which leads me for even greater concern for many of the veterans coming back from the current conflict and their families, which have to adjust as the veteran has to adjust and may not. And I think we need to take extraordinary efforts to make sure that the veterans and their families are okay. It's just so important. Thank you.
My first job as a public health nurse was in 1981, and my very first patient was this man, and I apologize if you've heard this story before, but I'd seen him roaming the streets and going into garbage cans, etc., and then some neighbors were complaining. So my very first patient, and thank goodness I had another public health care nurse with me, we went in and the stench was awful, and I started doing an assessment, and he actually had very bad sores on the lower legs. Actually, maggots were living in those sores, and it turned out that he had been discharged. He was a Vietnam vet, and he was discharged. With a few phone calls and referrals, he really should have been being treated right there in Blacksburg, Virginia, where I was living, but he, we got him into the VA system, and I forget where we sent him. Was it Roanoke or was it Richmond somewhere? Anyway, a follow-up report on him, and he was doing well. He was shell-shocked, and he was treated for his mental stability issues that he had, and he was doing fine, but he just needed care. And that, to me, I think is just a sin, just what you were sharing.
Could I just say one more thing? It's interesting, when I went to Carroll College in Helena, Montana, I worked at the VA hospital as an orderly for 2 years, which is interesting. And I worked on a variety of wards, and I did special duty for people who needed to be watched. And I was impressed with the care that the veterans from World War One were getting, and many of them were, I guess I won't classify all of them, but sheep herders who came in during the winter. Some of them had DTs, TB, various ailments, but they got, I thought they got superb care at that time. And I don't know what happened. My sister is a veteran, and she goes to the Veterans Hospital in Palo Alto for all of her care. She drives down. She's 83, drives, takes the bus, and has been in the hospital at different times, but she is getting superb care. But that's a different generation of veterans now. I don't know if we can say that for the current group of veterans.
Chair Moss, Anderson, members of the committee, a couple of thoughts, and then I'd actually like to hand it off to somebody who can speak to your point, sir. Mr. Plame in the back, who testified earlier, he has an interesting story I think you'll find compelling about the quality of care for VA health treatment now, which RAND rates is among the best in the world now, largely because of the lessons learned out of the Vietnam experience, I might add. I want to emphasize two quick pieces because I think they fit. The first is there is House Joint Memorial 3 on its way over, having to do with something called the 90-day soft landing. It has more to do with Guard and Reservists. When it comes before you, we'll talk about it at the time. One of the things we have learned, hard lesson over the last 4 years, is that the time that the military currently is providing Guard and Reservists, especially for transition back into normal, quote-unquote, normal life, is insufficient, and that it doesn't provide us enough time to see where the problems are. Second piece, which is not covered by anything specific other than the need for easier access to veterans' health care, is on its face, one could argue, well, we're up here today talking about the means test, and that's the problem. And it is a problem, but it's one of the many barriers. And what we're trying to get through is recognizing getting the barriers out of the way, because especially in this war, the kinds of pressures put on multiple deployments, longer deployments, and 2% of the population as opposed to what we have had in previous generations, we need to make sure we get people, kind of like Nathan Bedford Forrest used to say there, get there firstest with the mostest, get there as early as possible, make sure we can get people into the system and get them help. Otherwise, what we have seen, we believe, with the impact upon the veterans of the Vietnam generation that weren't given the kind of care that they needed, you're going to see that three or four times. And this is one of those situations in history where we can see the problem, we can look to history and say we could have done better here, and making access for health care easier, getting rid of the barriers, so that once a person is in the system, we can treat different pieces to the overall health, we believe is essential. And, sir, also just one other comment to Senator Moore said, we are actually currently working, the governor's office is working through Oregon Emergency Management with Lane County to try to make one of the armories available as a warming shelter, temporarily anyway, to help make sure that we don't have any more people suffer the way that the major did.
And I think we had,
real quick, just to address all those comments. Again, Kevin O'Reilly with the Oregon Paralyzed Vets for the record. When I climb on my bully pulpit, which I do sometimes and I won't do today, I will let you know that my opinion is that no veteran should have to go without health care. No veteran should have to go homeless, and no veteran should have to die alone. We are better than that as a nation. And thank you very much for that little...
I agree wholeheartedly with that statement, and actually I believe every individual should not have to go without health care, but we're working on that.
We could go without
Okay. Bob Plane.
Thank you again. I think Jim Willis and Paul Evans and others have sort of filled in what this is about, but as a veteran, as a Marine, it bothered me very much. I'm Category 1 in the VA system. I didn't realize there were categories until I got on the task force. When I look at other veterans and men I served with, who I have hooked up with after 40 years, who don't have the same privileges I have, it bothers me very much, and I believe it bothers other Marines and other service people, men and women. And for the young men and women who are going to serve, who are serving today, I'd like them to have the same benefits that I have. And so I support this, and I hope you do too. Thank you.
Thank you. This may be an appropriate time to maybe talk about the suicide effect.
Yes. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'll give you a brief summary of where we are as a nation currently with regard to veteran suicide. Every year in our country today, 6,000 veterans take their own lives. That's 16 people every day.
God.
The Oregon Violent Crime Reporting System, from the years 2000 through and including 2006, reported that 1,066 Oregon veterans took their own lives. That's an astonishing number. So the question for myself and for the members of my department and, in fact, for Oregon's veteran community was, what can we do to stop this? Well, what we determined, of course, right away was there needed to be a level of awareness about the issue that didn't exist. When I was a very young boy, I remember my parents and some adults with them talking about a friend who had the C disease. They just used the letter C, because cancer in those days was so frightening and so devastating, they wouldn't even say the word out loud. And that's where we find ourselves today in many cases in society, where we won't even say suicide. It's so repugnant. It's so difficult. It's so devastating to families that people want to keep it quiet. They don't even want to talk about it. It's exactly the wrong thing to do. We've got to talk about it. So in the middle part of December, right as we led into the holiday season, which, by the way, may be for some people one of the most depressing times of the year. It's hard to believe, but it is. We launched a multimedia campaign through radio and television, and from meeting with editorial boards of the major newspapers to raise the issue of suicide awareness and prevention, here in our state at least. And I'm happy to tell you that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has also launched a very strong campaign in this same area. Just 10 days ago, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs reported that through their suicide prevention hotline, they had made 2,600 saves by people, family members, or veterans themselves who'd called in and as a result were directed to treatment. What we have to remember about suicide is that it's a long-term solution to what in most cases is a very short-term problem. It could be financial, it could be domestic, it could be substance abuse, it could be a combination of these things, or it could be the residual effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, or traumatic brain injury, or any number of illnesses or injuries associated with wartime service. So by simply directing friends, family, employers, and others who care about veterans who are demonstrating inordinately difficult behaviors, having to do in most cases with depression, we simply direct them to 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. And when they get to that number, it'll say, press 1 for veteran, and you're instantly in touch with someone who knows how to direct that family member, that friend, that employer, or the veteran themselves to help that's available immediately. In every one of the veterans' medical institutions is a suicide prevention specialist that's available to our veterans and to work with them. Our counties have mental health specialists who are available to work with family and the veterans themselves. So by using this 1-800-273-TALK program, we found that we can make a difference. And as an example, if we're losing 6,000 veterans a year to suicide, and in the first use since July of 2007 of this hotline, we've saved 2,600 people. We've already saved over one-third of those that were at risk across our nation. So we're not going to give up on this issue here in Oregon, and you're going to continue to hear a lot more about what we can do in terms of the print media publications that we've put out. In many cases, they're poster format with a quick, hard-hitting message. And the key to this thing in terms of the veterans themselves is that you showed courage on the battlefield.
And we're going to ask you to show courage one more time by making this phone call. We've got to make sure that seeking mental health assistance does not stigmatize the currently serving soldier, sailor, airman, or marine, or the member of the Guard and Reserve. That can't happen. If they're stigmatized by seeking mental health issues, mental health treatment, excuse me, for issues like suicide or post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury, then the whole system's going to fail. Now, most key military leaders clearly understand this, both at the active duty level and at the Guard and Reserve level. I think there's strong support. So we have to make sure that our veterans understand it's okay to come forward, too, even after you're discharged, and there's no stigma attached. So we don't want to leave a bunch of orphan children. We don't want to leave a bunch of spouses behind when we know how to attack this very tragic circumstance, both in our state and in our nation. And I thank you, Senator Anderson, for raising this issue the other day before the committee and giving me an opportunity to talk about what we're trying to do about it here.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Thank you. First of all, if you're reading something, I'd like to have a copy of it if you're reading it. Secondly, I heard on the news not too long ago, a week ago, that there was going to be a stand down in the military. So apparently people don't know about it completely in the military. Apparently there's still a lot to learn.
Chair Anderson and Senator Morissette, that's correct. There was a major stand down in San Antonio, Texas, that addressed this issue. This one, particular one, was sponsored by the United States Army, who reported just last year that 128 active duty soldiers took their lives. So that's an issue in all of our services, but that's the number the Army published. And in Oregon, veterans are taking their lives at about 100% more than non-veterans. So that's a devastating number, and we've got to continue to work on that.
And I think it's important that suicide is like at the tip. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
Think how many under there are having such severe issues.
Correct.
Yeah. Chair Monson, members of the committee, this is one of those issues. The last 2.5 years working for Governor Kunkowski has been a blessing for me personally. As a veteran of Iraq twice and Afghanistan once, I have sometimes a hard time managing the objective-subjective line. But I want to comment on a couple of things that are relevant to this discussion and then tell you why I think sometimes the why is more important than the what. First, of the last 8 funerals that Governor Kunkowski has attended, and again, those are very personal events for him. He is now, I mean, quite frankly, the military sees him as a member of the family because it is a genuine and is an important thing to him. Of the last 8, 4 have been suicides. So after today, when you go on with the rest of your business and you hear the term military suicides, these are currently serving members, not veterans that have struggled for years. These are folks that can't make it right now while they're in uniform and have potentially help more available, one might argue. The concern I have, looking over the horizon of the next 4 to 10 to 20 years, is several pieces. The first is, for good or ill, whether it is intended or not, Iraq will cease to be a major combat operation in the next 24 months, probably far less than that, but we'll just say at least 24 months or less. My belief is that you will see the mental health concerns and challenges go up when men and women that have spent 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years engaged in that conflict recognize that it was lost and that they try to figure out, like I have, where those years went. That's going to be a big challenge. Second piece that is important to recognize is how we fight wars is fundamentally different than it used to be. And this takes about 2 or 3 minutes, but I think it's important. When the United States in World War II rose to the challenge, we went from what was largely a very small active duty with a militia and a very small reserve. A year prior to the war, they began the draft process, but over the course of the World War II, we went to 16 million men and women under arms. as we fought the war, it's easy to understand, a little easier to understand, at least look in the Pacific Theater, a unit would prepare, would train, would fight an island campaign, would be pulled off, go to Australia or some other place to reset, to R&R, to get replacements. Then they would begin preparing for the next operation, and then they would go in. So while 90-95% of males the age to serve served in one form or another, the way in which we fought the war, you weren't on the line the entire time if you went. Vietnam was somewhat different in that the draft was in place beforehand, and there were a number of different circumstances, and the numbers, at least we can get our hands on, is about 30-40% of males that were the draft age population did serve. But it still affected every family. People would have to think through what decision their child or their young son was going to make. In Vietnam, however, if you were drafted, which Jim was not.
Some of us were.
Some of us were. The deal was, generally, for an involuntary service requirement, you would spend 11 to 13 months overseas in Vietnam, and that was it. If you have spent more time in Vietnam or other theaters during that time, it was because you were a career person at that point. The government would not hold you over for more than one tour. But 30 to 40% of the folks had served. In this particular war, 2% of the American population, that's 0.2%, have any direct connection to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We didn't institute a draft. We didn't institute a large-scale mobilization in terms of more soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines in. We dealt and dwelt on using the National Guard and the reserves to levels that had never been used before. At one point in Iraq, there were actually more Guard reservists than there were active duty. That's now down to, I believe, about 38% or so, but that was the case then. Why it's important is, again, how we fight the wars. You're serving multiple tours. Those tours can go from 9 to 16 months with a stroke of a pen, depending on escalations or there's some other terms to use for it. And because of the increasing concerns in Afghanistan, a lot of the troops right now are being told their tours are going to be longer because they just can't keep the numbers up. You'll hear in the press that the military's kept up the recruitment numbers. Well, one of the figures that is used to make that appear that way is that the inactive ready reserve has been used since 2001, which means that the folks that have served their 4 years on active status in some capacity, they go into a four-year dormant period, and they've been pulled back. I'm saying this to put forward the larger picture. Fewer people, more times, and the icing on top is World War II, and even, I would argue, through most of Vietnam, the tooth-to-tail ratio was about 1 to 10, meaning that for every trigger puller out in the line, you had 10 support, truck drivers, cooks, all the logisticians, all the things necessary to make that happen. Because of the way this war was fought, largely through the use of contracted services for support services, that number is 1 to 3 or 1 to 4, meaning instead of one chance out of 10 of being in consistent violent situations, it's 1 out of 3 or 1 out of 4 multiple times. And in Oregon, the thing that makes it more difficult for Oregon is we don't have an active duty base outside small Coast Guard posts. How is that important? It's important like this. One of your colleagues recently, who I actually am very good friends with, asked what the difference is. Why didn't I hear these same kinds of stories about my father? I don't understand this. It followed by, well, my father never talked about it. Well, I'd like to politely suggest that your fathers did talk about it, just not to you. They talked about it at the VFW halls. They talked about it at the American Legion halls. They talked about it to other vets that had that same experience. In Vietnam, for a lot of reasons, didn't have that option. A lot of those organizations had different political views, and a lot of folks came back and weren't accepted even by their own warrior class. This generation of warriors has no connection. They have no history to places where they can go and commingle and get some of that venom out of them. They don't have the mentors. They don't have, in some cases, even fathers or uncles or others that have served to try to figure out how to put things back together. And as a person who's been through the cycle a couple of times, I can tell you, you can keep a smile on your face and you can keep pushing on about 12, 18 months, but then the wheels fall off the cart. And that's when suicide and other things that are not ever good options appear better than they are. Anyway, I apologize for taking the committee's time, but I really believe that Oregon, like the other places that don't have communities of support with active duty structure, is even more at risk, and that the suicide rates are going to be higher unless we take swift action. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, we don't have the legislative fiscal, and while you're still there, just we still have SJM-4, so I'll close the public hearing on SJM-3 and open a public hearing on SJM-4. Mr. Shook?
Madam Chair, SJM-4 urges Congress again to enact legislation that requires all public institutions of higher education and private institutions that receive federal funding to waive mandatory fees and tuition for family members of service members killed or severely disabled in line of duty.
Mrs. Wayne Harvey and Bert Key. And Kevin O'Reilly. Yes, Paul Evans.
Chair Monson, I just want to say this may be a great idea, but it is not a task force bill.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought that to our attention.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Wayne Harvey. I'm the current president of the Retired Enlisted Association for the State of Oregon. Our organization represents approximately 1,000 veterans that have retired after serving in enlisted ranks for over at least 20 years of their lives in active duty of the United States military. On behalf of the members of my organization and my fellow military retirees, I first want to thank the members of this committee and the rest of the Oregon Senate for finally establishing a Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs. As veterans' issues are becoming more and more critical, I hope that one day the Oregon Senate will have a standalone committee for veterans' affairs to focus specifically on those issues. I come to you today to ask you to do what is needed to make Senate Joint Memorial 4 a reality so we can let our federal legislators know what they can do to help those veterans and their families. I want to also thank the Oregon legislator for passing House Bill 1066 during last year's special session and getting it into Oregon law. I want to sincerely plead with this committee to work with your colleagues in the House this year to pass House Bill 2035, which would remove the arbitrary date of September 11, 2001 from that law and to expand the coverage to include community colleges in the most expeditious manner possible. I am personally affected by these bills and laws, as I am a 100% rated disabled veteran, and my children cannot afford a college education without incurring massive amounts of debts, you know, through Sallie Mae or some other similar bank where they owe $150,000 for 4 years of college. And since I'm 100% disabled and have had suicidal thoughts in the past, I apparently can't get life insurance. So if I was to die tomorrow, my children would have no monetary benefit and no help from the federal government or the VA. And so I would just like to encourage you to pass Senate Joint Memorial 4 as quickly as possible and to also help the members of the House with House Bill 2035 and correcting that date. It was a good piece of legislation, but it left off a great portion of the veterans population, those members that got out prior to September 11th. We're not included in that piece, so their family members are not covered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairwoman, Senators and Administrators, my name is Bert Key. I have lived in Oregon for 58 years and in Sandy, Oregon for the last 30 years. I appear before you as a member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Post 4273 in Sandy, and I appear in support of Senate Joint Measure 4. I am now retired, but I and the gentlemen on my left and right, and many in the room, have spent many years in the armed services uniforms of this nation, supporting and defending the constitutions of both the United States of America and the state of Oregon. I personally served 28 months in Vietnam with the Marine Corps back in the 60s. I spent a year in Bosnia in 1999 and 2000 with the United States Army. And I spent a year in Afghanistan in 2004 with the Army. According to my evaluation reports, I had a very successful career. I do not tell you this for myself, but rather as a way of demonstrating that a successful career is not something that an individual accomplishes on their own. I had a lot of help from those who served with me, both as superiors and subordinates. Wherever I have had the privilege to serve this great nation, I have been guided by one supreme principle of leadership, and that is take care of your soldiers. Taking care of one's subordinates is the single most important thing that a leader can do. When every person on a team knows that they will be taken care of, they will do their utmost for the success of the mission. When every member of the team knows that no one will be left behind, you have a tight-knit and dedicated team. When the members of that team know that their families will be taken care of in the case of their passing, it gives them a little more edge in facing any stressful situation at hand with 100% of their attention. Senate Joint Memorial 4 is an opportunity for the state of Oregon to show the nation how deeply we care for the educational health and welfare of our veterans' families. It is an opportunity for the state of Oregon to demonstrate that we take care of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. It is an opportunity for the state of Oregon to show the entire country that we Oregonians appreciate and respect our veterans. It is an opportunity for the state of Oregon to demonstrate to the nation that we will leave no one behind. And, of course, another important aspect of Senate Joint Memorial 4, especially in this day of the economic downturn, is that it will cost the taxpayers very little, if anything. Ladies and gentlemen, please help us take care of our own by sending Senate Joint Memorial to our national leaders and let them know that Oregon will leave no one behind. I often get thanked, especially nowadays, for my military service. And I would like to extend that thanks to you for your service as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your service, all of you.
Senator Moniz Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I'm with the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, the state chapter of a National Veterans Service Organization. And this, of course, is a very exciting and interesting memorial to the national leaders. It's one of those things that you wonder why it took us so long to do this. Why are we just now talking about it? It's timely, it's past time. And it really would be a boon to our disabled veterans and, of course, to the orphans and widows and widowers of those who lost their life in line of duty. And we fully support it. Thank you very much. Of course, any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer. Probably won't be able to, but I'll try.
Any questions? Not at this point in time. All right. These will be discussed in our caucuses. We won't be moving the bill today, but we will certainly keep you informed as to how it's moving through the process.
Thank you so much for coming.
With that, I'd like to close the...
Kevin, we have two more bills you can stick around and testify on.
SJM 4, and I'd like to open... we have one more... that's all right. We'll do yours last. Okay. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 400.
Do 400 now?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 400 authorizes the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to issue a shellfish license to veterans at no charge with written proof of veteran status and shows person to be at least 25% disabled. Madam Chair, we did receive an amendment yesterday that would increase that 25% to 30%.
Okay. Kevin O'Reilly and Kurt Melcher.
Well, Madam Chair, just
yes.
An explanation of the amendment was 25% was kind of an arbitrary number thrown in there. The veterans determined disability by numbers with a zero after them, so we went to 30%, which is a number that is actually recognized. So.
Kevin?
I guess I'll start. Senator Moniz Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the Paralyzed Veterans of America. We support the bill. It seems, you know, reasonably appropriate. There would be two things, and one is, as already mentioned by Senator Cruz, the VA and Department of Defense don't do things by 5%. They do it by 10%. So we would recommend dropping it to at least 20%. Of disability as awarded by the VA or the Department of Defense. And we would also request that we drop the word war from the bill. Sometimes we go to war when there isn't a war. And this has a tendency, that word has a tendency to confuse veterans. Often a veteran, even though they served during a period of war, they may not have served in combat. And they'll read the word war and say, I'm not a war veteran. And they won't know that that benefit still applies to them. So again.
We actually passed, I think it was Senate Bill 96, that will revamp all definitions of the word veteran, and it eliminates war veteran from the statutes. And that just passed the Senate a few days ago, and or yesterday. It'll go to the House.
It'll go to the House, right.
It would be taken care of there.
Yeah, that would be a conflict amendment.
Okay.
So.
And, well, let's hear from Kurt Melcher.
Thank you, Chair Moniz Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I did provide written comments as well, and for the sake of time, I'll be brief. This bill, Senate Bill 400, would authorize the Department and the Fish and Wildlife Commission to issue free shellfish licenses to disabled war veterans, as currently written, with a minimum disability of 25%. I would note that this is entirely consistent with how the commission is treating fishing and hunting licenses, and in statute, disabled war veterans do qualify for free fishing and hunting licenses at that same 25% criteria. So this bill is consistent with how we treat fishing and hunting licenses. It does have some reduction in revenue, and we can actually estimate what that revenue is. We issue, for instance, in 2008, we issued 8,800 free fishing and hunting licenses to disabled war veterans. Out of those 8,800 individuals, 1,600 basically also then subsequently purchased a shellfish license. Those individuals under this bill would receive that for free. It would have essentially a reduces the revenue to our shellfish account by about $10,000 per year. Administratively, this is no additional workload for our staff. We have a form that we currently use, and we obviously are already going through the process with these folks to verify their qualification for the free fishing and hunting license, so adding shellfish would be no additional administrative burden. With that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to comment today, and happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Thank you. That explains why the 25% is in there, because it's in your statute. So I'm assuming that to qualify a veteran would have to be at 30%, because at 20 they wouldn't qualify, because that's the way they're categorized. Would that be correct?
Chair Moniz Anderson, Senator Cruz, the current statute with regard to fishing and hunting licenses does specify 25%. So if, and I'm not familiar with the criteria, but if in fact they only do it in 10% increments, then you are correct.
Okay.
And how does someone know whether they're 20% disabled or 30% disabled? I know that in talking with Jim Willis about this and Paul Evans, 50% disabled, 60% disabled. Probably everyone at this table is at least 40% disabled. But what is, how do you?
The VA and the Department of Defense make those determinations.
Okay.
And the criteria, of course, varies.
Because that is information that I would like to have, how you determine the disability and the number of veterans in the state that are at.
It's a highly complex and unknown methodology, but we'll get it for you.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? All right. Well, we have, again, not all the paperwork.
Right. Madam Chair, I mean, it's just the impact on the agency isn't much. It's just the one piece that was missing, so.
All right. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 400, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 379.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 379 prohibits certain health care facilities from employing or contracting with surgical technologists unless they meet certain educational and training requirements and maintain a certified surgical technologist credential issued by the National Organization approved by the Department of Human Services.
All right. Brian DeLashmet.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As you look at the sign-up sheet, you'll see that I signed in twice. There's a reason for that, and I wanted to let you know the reason for that. I signed up on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association with one position, and not conflicting position, but signed up on behalf of the Association of Surgical Technologists as well. So let me start by giving you a little history. I'll put my ONA hat on first. Historically, this issue has been around for a number of years. My history with this issue goes back, I think, 8 years or three sessions prior to this, in which there was a series of work sessions amongst the parties to see if we couldn't get to an agreement. That went on the entire session. Ultimately, the bill failed. Subsequent to that, my colleague with the Oregon Nurses Association, who's no longer with them, Martin Taylor, convened basically the same participants over a series of time and actually brought everybody to an agreement, actually following the directive of the legislature. In many cases, they say, we don't want to hear about this, go away, figure it out, come back to us, give us the solution. And the parties did that. So the history obviously is that ONA started at one position. The bill has now morphed, and ONA is now neutral on the bill and believes it's a rational solution to the issue that you're going to hear today. Now let me put my AST hat on. Which means the Association of Surgical Technologists. For purposes of full disclosure, because there is an agreement between the parties, the association has asked me on their behalf to also represent them. And I wanted to make sure that it was good that I really have two hats in this, but the hats are agreeing on what the solution is. You'll have some parties come up and talk to you about the need for the bill and, to a certain extent, the design of the bill. And I'll be available for questions after they go through. But let me point out three things that I'm aware of that this bill still needs to be fine-tuned. The holdup on the bill last session was how do you fund this process and how do you collect the dollars? Given the financial straits that the state of Oregon is in right now, that question continues to be at the forefront. The parties are continuing to work out how they'll actually collect these fees, but I believe there is a solution at hand, and it will not be from general fund dollars. It will be achieved by the surgical technologist. So not to worry that we're committing this legislature or the state to a program that's not going to be self-sustaining. That language is yet to come. The second and third piece are questions that have come up since the bill was drafted that we believe need further clarification. So there'll be a second set of amendments. You already have the Dash 1 amendments, which actually represent the agreement as all of the parties understood it, with some minor language changes. But the two additional issues that need to be clarified are the issue if And this bill has grandfathering in for those folks who are currently practicing in this area. The question was if one of these parties, someone who's functioning as an AST in a facility and is grandfathered in, if they were to leave that facility and go to facility B instead of facility A, are they still grandfathered in? And the answer to the question is yes. That was always the intent. So these folks are free to move. Once they're grandfathered in, as long as they're meeting the continuing education requirements that are laid out in the program. The second question was for those students who have completed the program at a institution, in many cases community colleges, can they in fact work until they have taken, studied, taken, and passed the exam, that in the future they would be required to have the certification in order to be employed. And so that will need to be clarified as well. It's our intent that normally they study and take this exam up to six months after they have graduated. And so we would include that in another set of amendments as well. With that, I'll let the surgical technologists speak and the nurse who's there here today speak. If there's technical questions about what's going on in other states and so forth, we also have the resource of someone from the National Association in the room.
Yes, and I think that we need to, Senator Morsett has worked tirelessly on this bill. He's been a great supporter. So we want to have him come forward. But Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just probably one outstanding concern still, and I'm not sure it's addressed appropriately, is especially in some of our more rural hospitals, if a surgeon loses a member of his scrub team and doesn't have somebody certified available, he should be able to add, you know, so he doesn't have to go in and play 4-on-5 basketball. So, I mean, that's got to be addressed. I mean, it's simply an issue of this is fine, but with all other healthcare professions at this point in time, we have shortages, and we need to make sure that we aren't hamstringing the ability of a surgeon to staff his team for surgery just because we don't have the resource available. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we believe that provision and the ability for a rural hospital to get an exception for somebody to function in that kind of a situation is already in the bill. If, however, in your reading of the bill, you don't think that's clear enough, we would be happy to clarify that. But I think, for the record, that has been and is the intent. The two issues that were raised very early on several years ago was the issue of grandfathering and the issue of the inability to find somebody that meets these certification in rural hospitals, and we think those are both addressed in this bill.
Okay, and I guess just to follow up it, I mean, you know, if we're just talking A and B, that's one thing, but there are some DRG hospitals that I think, I just want to make sure we're clear on that I know there's some DRG hospitals that are having recruiting problems for all levels of staffing, and I just want to make sure that we do a lot of things that identify rural, and we have definitions of that, so I just want to make sure that we're comprehensive enough to address that as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, point well made.
All right. With Senator Morsett and Deborah Turner and Sarah Breckenridge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morsett, Senate District 6. This has been a long journey. We've worked on this. This is the fourth session we've worked on this bill. And it is, I think, truly a patient safety bill. These are the only professionals who are not certified or licensed. And it's kind of interesting because where do the surgical technologists come from in case of an emergency? From the candy stripers. I'm not kidding either. A lot of the people who are recruited and who become surgical technologists are people who are working in hospitals, and they express an interest and they get involved and they learn on the job, which is fine. But what the association wants to have is certification, licensure, respect, educational opportunities, and to become true professionals. And that I think, is what this bill is about. There are a number of compromise issues. I don't think compromise. The bill has been improved tremendously over the years in addressing some of the concerns that have been raised. By the first session, the surgical nurses did not support this bill for a variety of reasons. I think, though, that we've addressed several issues, including the funding of it. That's always been an issue, the fiscal impact, and the association has decided that they would, you know, take care of the cost. The hospitals are neutral on the bill, but the bill would require ultimately that they, when they do hire, in a non-emergency situation, that they hire people who are certified. Now, there's ample room in the bill for the contingencies of shortages, and I think that's been addressed. There's also an interesting new terminology, I think, in the dash ones. Instead of scope of practice, we solve that problem by saying range of function. How's that? Scope of practice is always a concern. I think the scope of practice that the surgical technologists have is fairly well defined, and those also, I think, can be worked out. There are a couple of amendments pending. DHS has worked with us in drafting the bill and have some concerns about the reporting and how they are going to keep track, and I think that they will have, unless they've already submitted it, some language that helps to clarify that. When I had my hip replacement, my second hip replacement, I was lying on the gurney and I looked up and who did I see but my own surgical technologist, Deborah Turner, and I said, "Deborah, would you please put an X mark on my right hip, because I've already done my left hip, and I just don't want to do it over again." And so Deborah did do that. So this has been an interesting journey, and I think that we will succeed if you support what you hear. So with that, I'll turn it over to the experts.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Senator Moniz Anderson, committee members. My name is Deborah Turner. I'm a certified surgical technologist, certified first assistant. I live in Eugene. I work for Slocum Center of Orthopedics in Eugene as a surgical assistant. We are here today regarding Senate Bill 379, which would require entry-level education through an accredited program, and then the member would then be able to sit for the certification exam and then be qualified to work. The Oregon Association of Surgical Technologists supports state certification of the surgical technologist, and this would ensure patient safety. The surgical technologist is the only healthcare professional that works in the operating room that is not regulated in this state. The surgeon, the anesthesiologist, the nurse anesthetist, the RN that circulates in the room, they're all regulated in the state. But the surgical technologist is not. It seems like that we should regulate with at least a mandatory certification of this individual. The state of Oregon would not have a nurse or physician working in any of our hospitals without a license. So again, the same should be true for the surgical technologist with at least mandatory certification. As of January 2009, there are 450 surgical technology programs throughout the United States, and they graduate 5,000 surgical technology students each year. With the prerequisite skills of surgical procedures, aseptic technique, and there's no reason to train people for a few short weeks or months to fill these positions when we have qualified individuals to do so. In Oregon, we have two surgical technology programs, Mount Hood Community College. They have a two-year associate's degree. That's in Gresham. We also have Concord Career Institute, which has a nine-month program. Both of these programs are accredited, and they will be able to set for their certification exam. In December 1972, the American Medical Association Council on Medical Education adopted and recommended educational standards for the field, and the Accreditation Review Committee on Education and Surgical Technology was formed. The specialized accreditation of programs in surgical technology began in 1974, implementing standards of a compliance that was developed by the American College of Surgeons and the Association of Surgical Technologists. Certification as a surgical technologist provides evidence to employers, other healthcare professionals, and the public that the certified individual has met the national standard for the knowledge which underlies surgical technology practice. We are a profession that is delegated by multiple professions, the MD, DO, PA, podiatrist, dentist, and nurses. This can be in multiple settings, clinics, day surgeries, hospitals, operating rooms, central supply, and in the x-ray department, assisting with cardiac casts and pacemakers. There is a grandfather bill, like we talked about earlier in our bill, grandfather clause, and this would help keep those that are working in the job continue to work as long as they have worked two out of the last 3 years. Wish to thank you for your time today and for listening. I have been in the field of surgical technology for 33 years, 21 of those years in the state of Oregon. We have pride for what we do for our profession, and we want to protect our patient, and that should be on everyone's agenda today. Thank you. If you have any questions, we'd be glad to answer those for you.
I have for 2 years, Ms. Townsley, Margie Townsley from Idaho, came and lived with me. I didn't know her. She wanted to attend the surgical technology program at Mount Hood Community College. So for 2 years, she lived with me, so I got to know what the program was about. She's now practicing in the state of Virginia.
Good. Hi, my name is Sarah Breckenridge, and thank you for this opportunity to speak in favor of Senate Bill 379. I'm a registered nurse who has worked in the perioperative setting since 1972. I'm a graduate of OHSU. My career has included 20 years at OHSU and 13-plus years at several small hospitals in Lincoln and Yamhill counties. I currently work as Director of Quality Outpatient Surgery in Hillsboro. My experience ranges from staff nurse to department director. I represent myself and my patients. I have worked extensively with my surgical technologist colleagues throughout their process of developing this piece of legislation. Accredited academic preparation for the surgical technologist is essential for safe patient care. We work in an environment where we prepare for war and pray for peace. Patient safety is my passion. I ask that you consider the serious nature of what my colleagues and I do in our everyday practice in the care of the surgical patient. Recently, an owner of the contract specialty surgery service approached my son at the local Starbucks, where he was the barista, asking him if he would be interested in working for him. He described the service and stated that he would train him to do the procedures. He would bring the supplies and equipment into the institution, prepare for the procedure, and assist the physician with the procedure, eye procedure. I have worked with these types of services before. They are brought in to do these procedures due to the expense of the supplies and the equipment and the low frequency of doing these type of procedures for the contracting institution. We are now having a barista becoming the expert in the room. Their understanding of sterile technique, sterile processing, and patient care is limited. I could go on and on. The focus of this,
just explain again that this is happening where?
This was happening in Washington County.
Okay.
This encounter was in Washington County. The focus of this bill is to place the responsibility of the employer to hire only qualified surgical technologists. Your constituents deserve a standard of care that is consistent whether they have their surgical procedure done in a single operating room or in our large hospital multi-specialty operating room settings. I ask your support as a patient advocate, as a member of the team in the operating room. I must have confidence that my coworker has an understanding of the complexities of the environment and the standards that are the foundation of our combined practice. We all have a lot to do during the surgical procedure and very little time to do it. When I'm circulating, I do not have time to worry if the surgeon knows what he or she is doing. I also do not have time to keep an eye on the surgical technologist. My eye is on the patient. This is a win for everyone, and especially for the patient, who is at their most vulnerable time and trusts that everyone that they have trusted their very essence of their life is fully prepared to care for him or her. Thank you.
Have you worked with the ambulatory surgical centers? Are they on board? I know I haven't heard from them. I've definitely heard from the hospitals. But
I used to work, previous to this position, I worked in an ambulatory surgery center, and from that perspective, from that one especially, very much on board. I mean, safety is the essence of their business, and they can't afford mistakes.
And the Slocum Center that I work for is an ambulatory surgery center, and they are also on board.
Okay. All right. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have evidence of compromised patient safety with the system that we now have?
Well, I think what is it, the National Institute of Health, and they're talking about the never events and how many, you know, I think what it is, 60% of the never events happen within the operating room. We have to have a team that is on board, working together, and knowledgeable of the standards, as I spoke. So, yes, the operating room is a place of never events.
Has there been complaints regarding this? Have there been errors?
Since we are not a regulated profession,
yeah,
we do not have a database for that. I do wish I had that information. That is something that I believe that the Patient Safety Commission will be collecting, but at this time, we do not have that. It's at the hospital. It goes to the hospital risk management. They then take care of it in-house, and that person is either spoken with and it's taken care of within the hospital, or they're let go. But the thing is, when they're let go, then they can go on to the next hospital and get a job, and nothing is ever done about whatever happened.
The hospitals have a position on this bill?
They'll be coming forward to talk.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, no further questions? All right.
Madam.
Yes.
Chair.
Excuse me.
Yeah, Senator Bill Morissette. I liken this position to any other very technical team of people who work, and whether it be the airlines, the pilot, the co-pilot, the people that he has around them, and so on. And I think that it does take some expertise when a physician is doing surgery and reaches out for an instrument. He wants to be sure that whoever is handing it to him understands the procedure and so on. Not to say that you can't train a person on the job, but I think it's time that we recognize the critical people in the hospital room as part of a professional team. Medical errors, it's a systemic problem, and it's a system problem, and I think the entire team is part of that system, and all of them need to have the certified education and qualifications to be there. So I just think it's past time that we address this issue.
Any further questions? All right. With that, I'd like to call Gwen Dayton and Grant Higginson up. Gwen from the Hospital Association and Grant from the Department of Human Services.
Chairman Sanders and members of the committee, my name is Gwen Dayton. I'm the Executive VP and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this bill with you. The hospitals are neutral on this bill, and let me explain how we balance the pros and the cons on this. Like the proponents of this bill, the core mission of all hospitals is to provide the best quality of care that we can. And to do that, we need to have the best trained practitioners that we can. And we then, of course, support the motivations behind this bill to provide those very practitioners. We have to balance this, though, with the concerns that Cruz expressed and that we also share, that many hospitals, particularly in rural areas, face great difficulty in recruiting practitioners to provide care in their facilities. And in many ways, putting barriers up, potential barriers up, to finding people to provide the care actually can, in the end, harm our ability to provide quality care as much as help it. So it's with those thoughts that we looked at this bill. And at the end of the day, we do appreciate the balancing act that this bill really is. We appreciate the fact that it provides a waiver for healthcare facilities, of which hospitals are one, if we have made a diligent effort to find a person who is appropriately certified and simply cannot. We appreciate the grant, what we call the grandfathering clause in Section 9, that if somebody has been employed as a surgical technologist, they could continue in that role. And so for those reasons, we come before you expressing neutrality on the bill. We're not going to oppose the bill, but because of our concerns about the potential barriers, neither are we thoroughly supporting it. And I do want to express a few concerns that perhaps we can talk about with the proponents of the bill over time as this bill moves forward. We do think, as I think the Dash Ones do, we need some clarification in the grandfathering clause about employed at any healthcare facility, not just the one that is seeking the grandfathering of a position. We also would like to look at the waiver language a little bit. Senator Cruz, I appreciate your comment about what about the surgical technologist who suddenly is unavailable. Either they leave their position or they're suddenly unable to work. I question whether or not we really would be able to meet the terms of the bill and do a diligent and thorough search and get the waiver that we would need and the time frame that we would need to keep that OR open. I'm just being, you know, very practical. I would be interested in talking to proponents of the bill about whether there's some language we could include to accommodate that that situation, and I appreciate your raising that, Senator Cruz. I also understand this needs to be a fee-based system. But the hospitals will pay this fee. I mean, make no mistake. They're employed, the surgical technologists are employed by the hospital typically or contract with them. So we will need to be involved with the department in what that level of fee is because, as with everyone, and I won't go on and on, hospitals are also facing a lot of stress with the economic downturn, and we need to manage the level of fees that we're paying, which are going up in every venue. So that will be an issue that we will continue to follow and appreciate being able to participate in the process. With that, I would really like to thank the proponents of the bill, Mr. DeLashman and other supporters, for their willingness to consider some of the issues that many of us might have and involve us in the process of solving them. And we look forward to continuing that conversation. And I'm glad to answer any questions you might have.
Let's take a large hospital. And I don't know how many operating rooms a large hospital has, and I don't know how many operations they have going at one time. And if someone gets sick, and say the surgical technologist gets sick, mm-hmm. do they cancel the operation, or where do they go for resources?
Chair Montes-Anderson, a larger hospital typically will have more options than a smaller one, as you would imagine. A larger hospital could call on either other existing surgical technologists that they may have on staff, or nurses sometimes can also perform this task. I noted one of the issues that I have when I reviewed this bill is, well, what about nurses? Do they have to then get a separate certification in order to perform this role in the OR that they already are performing? And the answer is no, because the bill does accept them out. So in that circumstance, I would imagine, but I'm glad to follow up and get more of an answer from a hospital that they would just simply call another personnel. It's the smaller hospitals that simply don't have that depth of staff that we would have the concern.
And the waiver process, and again, I'm just focusing on the large hospital now because I see the problem, and I think the waivers cover the smaller hospital.
Yep.
But with the waiver, every 6 months you have to do a waiver and then there's language about a year, but then you're still able to get waivers after a year. So is that a cumbersome bureaucratic mess for small hospitals as well as large hospitals?
Senator Mona Sanderson, yes. That was one of the concerns we had when we read the bill. But we remain committed to working with the people who serve in our hospitals and, again, providing the best possible care we can. That is something that when we reviewed our position on this bill, we decided that we would accept. The waiver is something that is very helpful to hospitals. And, yes, the way it's set up is cumbersome. But we appreciate that it was included in the bill. And we appreciate that opportunity. Related to that, a little bit off your question, but we do look forward to working with the department on what diligent and thorough means so that we can clarify how all the steps that the department would need to have us demonstrate.
And my fear is that a hospital all of a sudden realizes they don't have someone to cover, so can they call DHS and within a matter of an hour, yes, you have a waiver?
Well, Senator Monison, and so that's what I was trying to get at with my earlier comment. I would like to work with proponents on this bill to have some language about not even necessarily using this word, but an emergency waiver. If we really need to get somebody in and we don't have the opportunity to be diligent and thorough as the language of the bill would require us to be, but we need to provide care as a separate hearing on a different bill, I think it was the senator said, if I'm in a crash on I-84, I really need somebody in that OR. Yes, they do. And we need to make sure we keep those ORs open. And so we would like the opportunity to work on some language to accommodate that.
And Senator Mona Sanderson, it sounds like that
introduce
kind
yourself.
Of directed to me, so
yeah.
I'm going to chime in here. I'm Dr. Grant Higginson, Administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And in answer to that question, you know, this will all be figured out by rules, and we'll have the Hospital Association there, and we'll have the Association of Surgical Technologists there. We're figuring this out. I actually see the acute crisis of hiring somebody a fairly easy waiver to get. I mean, I think that we would work out in rules that if someone, the only surgical tech available for a surgical team, you know, precipitously resigns their position and there's no one available, that should be a process where we can easily do something quickly. And I would think that the test of due diligence and effort put out to get that would be less than in other cases. I think it would be much harder, though, than 6 months from then, if they still can't hire someone, to show that they really have done the due diligence. So I think that's going to be a more difficult waiver for people to be able to get. And then the whole issue of this long-term, you know, possibly forever, a small hospital never having accessibility to certified surgical technologists, I think that's going to be a tricky issue that's going to be with us for a long time. And
so
Chair,
I would
should I finish up with
yes,
the rest of my prepared
do.
Testimony? As I said, I'm the administrator of an office that has healthcare licensing and certification within one of the programs, and consequently, I think this responsibility will be coming to me, particularly since we do right now keep track of the certification status for hemodialysis technicians. So in some ways, there are some similarities. The department is neutral on this bill, the policy implications of this bill, but there are some administrative aspects that we do need to talk about. We are given a number of responsibilities in the bill. One is just first to set up the rules for the certification process and certification standards for surgical technologists. That's something that we can do fairly quickly and fairly easily. We are also, though, given the whole waiver process that we've been discussing as a responsibility, we are also responsible for the process where surgical technologists can get grandfathered in to the profession. And then we're also responsible for checking to make sure that hospitals are doing what they say they're doing and what the law says they are supposed to be doing when we do routine inspections on hospitals. hospital sites. So all of those responsibilities are ongoing responsibilities, and consequently are going to require some additional staff. And it does in the bill give us the authority to charge fees. We thought about how we can charge fees, and there's a couple of different ways. So the way we do it with the surgical, with the hemodialysis technicians, is that we have them submit to us an application that shows their certification criteria have been met, and then they get a certification that lasts for 2 years, and that costs them $150. The other way to do it, however, and really the way that the sponsors and Senator Morissette has set up the bill, is to have the hospitals do as much as possible with all of the certification requirements for the surgical technologist. So the other way to do this, and the way that we have been asked by Senator Morissette to address this, would be to have the hospital responsible once every 2 years for telling us how many surgical technologists they have in their facility employed, and make sure that there are checks totaling the total amount due that's provided to us at that time. And that is the way that we can keep the cost the very lowest, and we think that the surgical technologist fee will be about $80 per biennium, or $40 per year.
Question.
So with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Well, what I'd like, since it looks like there needs to be just a little bit more work, is Senator Morissette with Mr. Shook and then the proponents of the bill, or just your staff, whatever you do, along with the hospitals and the Department of Human Services, if you could set up some time to discuss these issues then. All right. Yes, Senator Cruz.
I've expressed my concerns. My other concern is when you limit a university, you drive up the cost, and I am fearful that this is going to drive up the cost of this service over time.
Okay. Is there any other discussion? With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 379, and we are adjourned.